It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios, Jav Parrish, co-editor at Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Pretty good. No Maria this morning.
No, she's still sick.
What has she got?
Yeah, whatever she's got, don't get it.
Some sort of
radioactive, toxic cold kind of thing.
Mm.
But she's still out this week. I talked to her yesterday and again last night. And she'll hopefully be back next week. We'll be here for Christmas.
Yeah, good. Because it just wouldn't be Christmas without her.
And we'll be here for New Year's also. So we've got the holiday morning drill the next couple weeks.
That's right. So that's our present to you, the listeners. So
yes, indeed.
So things go on here in Washington State. The battle for the votes for governor.
Yeah, it goes on and on and on and on and on. The next venue will be the Washington State Supreme Court. That, thanks to a judge's ruling yesterday in Pierce County, that invalidated the 760-some ballots that have been found in King County this week, one in a batch of 516, another 170, I think, so it's 730-something total. But the judge threw that out yesterday, saying that it was too late for King County to discover the ballots, so that they won't be counted, even though they were perfectly... These are ballots that were perfectly legitimately cast. They're absentee ballots. They were misfiled when they came in. They set them aside to try and match the signatures, and they never found them again. One in a tray of ABCs and A's and B's and C, last name, and then the rest of the alphabet was elsewhere. That was the 560-some. And... it was just incompetence on the part of King County election officials, apparently. Of course, King County is by far the largest county in the state, 1.7, 1.8 million people. So it's not surprising that it's taken the longest for King County to vote. All of the other counties at this point are in. 38 of the 39 counties are now reporting, and Dino Rossi still has his lead of about 50 votes. This will be the ball game. If the 700 and some votes in King County, plus any others that may still be discovered, are counted, that could give Christine Gregoire the election, because she is consistently outpolling Rossi in King County by a substantial amount. She's won it by in the high 50s in terms of percentage, I believe. If the King County votes do not count, then Rossi will probably win the election. Now, there's a proposal out there. Ralph Monroe made this, and there's been mutterings elsewhere as well, that we should do what the Ukraine did. Go ahead and have a revote, which to me makes a whole lot of sense. If you've got 3.5 million votes that have been cast, and you're talking about a differential in the dozens, then you're talking about a statistical tie. I mean, it basically tied. And there are just all sorts of different things that could have come up, that could have swung the election one way or another, that that no matter how many times you recount, you're going to come out with a different count each time, and it's going to be inaccurate. There's no way to exactly know in an election this size. You can come up with a number. You can always come up with a number, but whether that number is accurate or not, it almost certainly is not going to be down to the exact, ones or even tens. And when you're talking about an election that is this close, it's simply anybody's guess who actually won. And when you have a winner-take-all election where it's 50% plus one, I got some grief this week for our having endorsed Ruth Bennett, and people asking, do you think you swayed more than 50 votes to Ruth Bennett that would otherwise gone to Christine Gregoire? And, maybe. But you can make that case for a lot of different things that could have influenced the election. Bennett, the Libertarian candidate, polled something like 80,000 votes. And those are 80,000 votes that either Rossi or Gregoire could have sorely wanted in this election. So that proposal is out there, but I think it's fairly unlikely that it's going to happen. It's almost certain that the decision by the state Supreme Court is what's gonna determine who our next governor is going to be.
Well, I like Ralph's proposal, and I've also heard proposals that the Washington State legislature could make the call on which it would go.
Yeah, that there's a couple different scenarios under which, under the state constitution, it would be thrown to the legislature. But that's a long shot at this point. That is not likely to happen. But it is possible under the state constitution if no decision can be reached.
No, I think people need to be voicing their opinions on this. So regardless. All right. Anything else on that?
No. Right. We'll know this time next week, probably.
Well, there was a decision this week on Thursday regarding Westlake Mall and freedom of speech.
Yeah, this is a lawsuit that stemmed out of the big anti-war protest on February 15th, 2003, where we had something like 50,000 people at Seattle Center. And there were a couple and then another individual that filed, Beth Sanders, that filed a lawsuit against the city of Seattle for being harassed by security guards at Westlake Mall when they were waiting to get on the monorail going to the food court area on the third floor of Westlake Mall in order to get to board the monorail to go to Seattle Center. And they were carrying signs because they were going to a protest. And when you go to a protest, you carry your signs, and you got to get signs to the protest somehow. Mm-hmm. And they were told not to display the signs inside Westlake Mall, that it was private property, and to take their signs elsewhere. And they objected, and they later filed a lawsuit, and they lost their lawsuit this week. The judge ruled that that while the area boarding the monorail to Westlake Mall was a public area, that it was a public area that was not intended for use as a free speech area, that it was of limited use, the egress to the monorail area, and therefore that the security guards were within their rights.
Whoa,
we just lost power.
We just lost our lights anyway. I wonder if we're still transmitting. It looks like our transmitter says we're still transmitting.
Oh, okay. Well, and our lights just came back on. That was very odd.
Okay. So that's the people at Westlake.
Yes. They're trying to shut down our free speech.
So hopefully you're still hearing us out there in radio land.
Well, we'll just continue as though you were.
Exactly. Never let that be a determinant. Anything else on that?
No, just that we lost that particular, or we didn't lose the lawsuit, but the people filing the lawsuit lost it, and so the precedent now is that Westlake Park is not available for free speech. Not Westlake Park. I'm sorry, Westlake Mall is
right.
and the ingress to Westlake Mall is not available in terms of free speech. Don't display your signs when you're going to Seattle Center on the monorail.
But they're going to challenge that. So
are they going to appeal?
Well, actually, they haven't. I'm sorry, they haven't said if they're going to, but I have the impression they would. All right, let's move along. Also, let's see, up this week, Seattle, the Sonics apparently want a taxpayer investment in their future.
Yeah, speaking of public-private partnerships in Westlake and Seattle Center, the Seattle Supersonics basketball team are hitting up the city. They've been in negotiations now actually for several months, but the story just came to light this week. Of the specifics of the proposal that they are asking the city for a re-divergence. Actually, they're going to be asking the state legislature for this during the legislative session with the agreement of Greg Nichols and the city of Seattle. That what they want is a redirection of the state of the city's motel and restaurant tax to the tune of $200 million. That motel restaurant tax is now partially being used to pay off Safeco Field and Quest Field, the baseball and football stadiums that were publicly financed. And what the Sonics want is that once those are paid off, they wanted to finance improvements at Key Arena. Now, Key Arena was substantially redone only about 10 years ago. It should be a relatively modern facility, but of course, modern in the terms of sports facilities that are paid for by the public only lasts about 10 years these days. You know, you remember not too long ago, people were complaining that the Kingdom was only 25 or 30 years old. Well, that's ancient history in terms of most cities' sports complexes now. They're the turnover seems to be about every 10 to 15 years now. They want these new playpens for these sports franchises. So it looks like the Sonics are looking for the taxpayer to pick up the tab once again to the tune of $200 million. And this is something that will go to the state legislature. It is not something that is necessarily going to go directly to the voters at all.
Because generally voters in the past have rejected giving stadiums money.
Yes, and then they go to the legislature anyway, and the legislature goes over their heads. But this is something that it might be worthwhile talking to your local state legislator about and representative. That if you're concerned about financing for sports stadiums and the sort of dubious economics of it, that it really doesn't generate that many jobs, that it's basically a form of corporate welfare. The corporation in this case being the sports franchise, and a fairly lucrative corporation it is as well. Because these sports franchises invariably sell for far more than they're bought for when they're sold. And the Sonics in particular were bought by Howard Schultz, who's the founder of Starbucks. He bought it, 5 or 6 years ago, could sell it for a substantial profit at any time that he chose. So, I mean, they have the money available to...
Right. Just like they did for the other sports stadiums.
Yeah, just
for... They didn't need the public funds on that.
No, I mean, you were talking about Paul Allen for the football team being one of the wealthiest individuals in the world. And, of course, that's how he gets that way. He gets that way by having the public pick up the tab for everything. And then also for the baseball club's owners were Nintendo and the various co-investors for the Mariners. They can afford to build their own stadiums, but the precedent of choice for all of these clubs now and elsewhere around the country as well is to have the public pick up the tab, and that's what's happening all around the country.
Right. So there, while we're talking about potentially shifting $200 million over to the Sonics on top of the billions, the couple billion we already got going to the other two stadiums, meanwhile the Seattle School District is coming up short on funds.
Yeah, this is ironic. We can have it for ball games, but we can't have it for education for our kids. We had an announcement this week that the Seattle School District is going to be $12.2 million short in its budget for the next school year for 2005-2006. And potentially $19.1 million short for 2006-2007. And this is this rose to talk by the district's financial people at a symposium that they gave for the school board this week of potentially declaring bankruptcy and having the school district being taken over by the state and being put in receivership if things don't change financially in the next couple of years. Now, it's not likely to come to that. What's likely to happen instead is layoffs, cutbacks in educational programs, and all sorts of other manner of budget cuts in order to try and close this shortfall. The school district does also have some money in reserve that it can use at this point. There's some money that hasn't been spent from this current school year. The surplus that hasn't been spent of I think about $1.5 million. There's some money that added on to the budget shortfall from a pension plan. And there's some money available to help cover that. So there are some fixes for a few million dollars of the 12.2, but there's still going to be a substantial shortfall. And what that means is that for the coming school year for 2005-2006, there's likely to be some layoffs. There's likely to be some cuts in programs for the kids. And there's also likely to be the superintendent is. Has made comment to this in the last couple of weeks that they're likely to start looking at the possibility of closing some schools as a way of saving money.
All right. Well, with that, I guess we'll jump over to international on this week in Iraq.
A lot going on this week. It's been 1 year since Saddam Hussein was captured, and as you remember, there was a lot of optimistic talk at the time that this would be the end of the insurgency, that the bitter enders would just give up and lose hope, and they would just fade into the woodwork, and democracy would be on the march, as President Bush so valiantly says week after week after week after week. But it hasn't worked out that way. We did have the beginnings of a trial this week for a couple of Saddam's top lieutenants, but Saddam Hussein himself is not likely to go on trial until early 2006 now, at the earliest. They're having trouble locating a judge who is willing to take on the case. They're having trouble locating qualified prosecutors for the case. They're having trouble coordinating a defense team. There's about 20 people on the attorneys on the defense team right now from headquartered in Jordan that has been hired by Saddam's wife, but nobody has actually met with Saddam Hussein from his defense team. But the biggest problem is a security problem, that they can't start the trial because they're worried about anybody, the judges, prosecutors, etc., becoming targets for the insurgency. And just the general security situation makes it very, very difficult to provide security for any kind of a trial like that. So it really is on hold. The trial was originally supposed to happen in time for the election last summer and fall. It hasn't taken place, isn't likely to take place anytime soon. When it does take place, the viewpoint from a lot of ordinary Iraqis is it's going to be very much the justice of the victor, that it's not going to be his countrymen holding Saddam Hussein accountable, which is what Washington would like us to believe, but that the Americans, who are so far paying for all of the cost of the possible prosecution and the research that's going on into Saddam's crimes over the years, the Americans so far are picking up the tab. It's very much our show, and it's being seen as something that's being run by the Americans for the benefit of the Americans at this point.
So a show trial.
Very much a show trial, yeah, and that's something that's not going to happen anytime soon, though. So, for people who were waiting for the insurgency to end, that's not going to happen anytime soon either. We were we're treated this week to more fighting in Fallujah. That was supposed to come to an end with the sweep through by Marines last month, but they've been sweeping through again and then sweeping through again and again and going door to door, or in this case wall to wall, because they just punch holes through the wall and go over to the next house. A lot of the tactics that the U.S. forces have been using in Fallujah and elsewhere in Iraq are pages taken out of the Israeli textbook. With what the Israeli army has been doing to the Palestinians for a number of years, and the punching holes in walls as a way to go from house to house is one of those things. Another is the fingerprinting and use of checkpoints, allowing people back into the Fallujah and other areas, where they're essentially setting Fallujah up as an enormous open air concentration camp where nobody is being allowed in or allowed out without being fingerprinted and ID'd. And subjected to fairly harsh security measures. Now, we had a number of other sort of related stories in the news this week. We had the American Civil Liberties Union announcing that through a Freedom of Information request that they had uncovered another 11 cases of Marines that have been charged and jailed with various prison abuses in the months since Abu Ghraib. And we had at the same time yesterday a British man, Jamal Al-Harith, was testifying before the Council of Europe, a panel there that is investigating abuses at Guantanamo Bay, the prison there. And he is testifying to the use of torture and some fairly horrific detention practices at Guantanamo Bay. As being fairly systematic, as being something that virtually all of the several hundred prisoners at Guantanamo Bay have been subjected to at one time or another, or even continuously since their detention up to 3 years ago now.
Right, and this is added to the other people who have come forward who were detention there that have reported the same.
Yeah, this is something that we've heard from a number of different sources at this point. And something that that Donald Rumsfeld is and Alberto Gonzalez, the nominee for Attorney General, are taking some heat for. There was a high-ranking group of admirals this week that came out Army people and various military muckety-mucks generals coming out saying this week that they were opposed to the Gonzalez nomination for Attorney General because they were concerned that the precedent that was being set by the flouting of the Geneva Conventions. And that our prisoners of war could be treated the same way as we are now treating other countries' prisoners of war. But be that as it may, we had that story. We also had the Army National Guard coming out this week. And the National Guard at this point is responsible for some nearly 40% of the 150,000 troops that are in Iraq at this point, and the troops that are in Afghanistan as well, are some 40% there, that they're having trouble filling up their enlistment quotas. They're down 30% in the last 2 months, and of course it's no secret as to why. They're in an active conflict, and whereas the usual commitment for the National Guard is something like, you know, a week and a month and then 2 weeks in the summer, now it means a year in Iraq, almost certainly. And this comes, a lot of the people that enlist in the Army National Guard do so once they're out of active service, and that's a way of staying in the military, of keeping the benefits and so forth. But at this point, and we're getting a very strange ringing sound here. It's definitely a day for technical glitches.
Yeah. As long as it doesn't end in an explosion.
Yeah. But that's
right.
It's singing to us.
Yeah. If we could do something about it, we would. But
yes,
anyway,
I hope that's not going over the air.
It's dogs everywhere, though, are freaking out.
Yes.
So, in addition on the National Guard thing, I also noticed because I read an article on it this morning that they are asking for $20 billion to replace equipment.
Yes.
They have expended.
To replace equipment they've expended or they've left in the country, and then they're also trying to boost the incentive for the enlistment quotients. This is getting worse and worse. This ringing.
Trying to push us out of here. So, all right. Well, anything else on that?
No.
All right. It was something else you couldn't help but notice this week. Another national missile defense test that pretty much didn't get off the ground.
Went kablooey. Yeah. This was, I'm not even going to try to pronounce the name of the atoll in the Pacific where they were launching from, but this was one of these hit a bullet with a bullet type things where they send up a fake missile attack from Kodiak Island in Alaska, and then the island in the South Pacific where they try and send up the missile to try and catch it, and then the missile didn't even launch this time. It aborted for some reason. They don't even know why. But this is a very expensive failure. This is the first time in 2 years that they've tried to actually test this particular component of national missile defense, and it adds to a long list of failures in these Star War programs. That being said, the Bush administration and President Bush have been sort of hell for leather in trying to deploy some portion of the national missile defense, the portion that might work, whichever that portion is. Have been doing so, even though there's been this long string over the past 2 or 3 years of test failures, and a number of the components for the missile defense are very much up in question at this point, as being technically dubious, and they don't even. I mean, it's an incredibly complex technical equation to try and get this to work. And there have been some questionings in Congress at this point about whether the latest test failure will lead to some defunding for missile defense. Some Republican senators have said, you know, if we can't even get money for our armoring for our troops in Iraq, and at the same time we're spending all of this money on this dubious technology for a non-existent threat. It seems like a strange use of priorities in terms of military spending.
Yeah. Well, we can only hope that they will cut some of the funding on that. So, all right. Well, we're still got a few minutes left. Talking with John Parrish, co-editor at Eat the State, and you guys are in the middle of or nearing the end of a seasonal fundraiser yourself.
Yeah, we do a fundraising drive twice a year, around May, June, and then again at the end of the year, just in time for the holidays and just in time for year-end tax deductibility gift giving. It's for Eat the State, which is this newspaper that Marie and I both work on and have for several years now, since 1996, that comes out every other week. With local and global news, largely volunteer run. We pay a little bit of a stipend to Lance to handle the handle the business end of things for us, so that we writers don't have to worry about things like that. But by and large, it's a volunteer publication. Nobody's getting rich off of it, that's for sure. It's very much a shoestring operation, and in the past couple months in particular, we've really been hurting for funds. In October, we generally need about $1,500 a month in order to print the publication, to mail out the copies to our mail subscribers. Those are our two biggest expenses, are printing and postage. And of the $1,500 a month that we normally need to raise, we only raised about $750 in October and less than $720 in November. So we've fallen behind by nearly a full month in terms of our ability to pay the printer and so forth. So we're very much looking for help, for donations to help keep printing. This is an ideal time of year to do it, to give gift subscriptions. You can do that over the web at www.eatthestate.org. You can send in donations to our mail address, which is P.O. Box 85541, Seattle, Washington 98145. And you can also volunteer because we're always looking for people to help out. It's very much a case of sort of shoestring independent media. That's a value to the community, and if you find it valuable, if you find the paper valuable, if you find what we do on Saturday morning valuable, then this helps keep us doing it. And I won't belabor the point because people have heard fundraising pitches before, but we do need the money. So anything that our faithful listeners can do to help out with that would be much, much appreciated.
Right. And you're also always looking for volunteers as well, in general, just like for distribution.
For distribution, for writing, for selling display ads, because we have local businesses that help us out as well with advertising. You know, any of those kind of things. Layout. All the things that you need in order to put out a small paper every couple of weeks. That's all the things that we need to have help with.
Okay, so. 206-903-9461?
That is the number. That's the voicemail number. Area code 206-903-9461.
All right.
And www.eatthestate.org. And you can find all of our back issues and T-shirts for sale and all other kind of good holiday gift-giving ideas at eatthestate.org.